Hello. This is episode 6 of The Hate Crime Files, a podcast about crimes typically involving violence, motivated by prejudice based on race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, or other grounds. I'm your host, Terrence Heath. This podcast covers disturbing events and may not be suitable for everyone. It is not recommended for young children. Listener discretion is advised. According to the best available data, hate crimes in the U.S. have increased in the Trump era. The Federal Bureau of Investigation reported that in 2017, the first year of Donald Trump's presidency, hate crimes rose by 17%. The most significant increase since 2001, when the 9/11 terrorist attacks fueled a surge in attacks on Muslim Americans. Race and religion were the two most significant drivers of hate crimes in 2017, with African Americans and Jews as the most targeted victims. There were 4,832 incidents motivated by race, ethnicity, or ancestry, an increase of 18% from 2016, and accounting for 58% of all hate crimes that year. Religion-based hate crimes jumped 23% to 1,564 incidents, the second highest number on record. Reported anti-Hispanic and Latino crimes also rose by more than 24%, and anti-American Indian or Alaskan Native crimes rose by nearly 63%, although the number of incidents in these categories was still overall far lower than, for example, anti-Black and anti-Jewish incidents. Nearly 16% were motivated by sexual orientation. The rest were motivated by disability, gender identity, gender, and multiple kinds of bias. Data for 2018 won't be available for several months. Hate crimes have increased for three consecutive years. In 2015, hate crimes increased by 4.6% compared to the previous year. The total tally of hate crimes in 2016 was 6,121 compared to 5,850 in 2015. Nearly 59% of the victims were targeted because of their race. A further 21.1% were targeted because of religion, and 16.7% because of their sexual orientation. The FBI data may be the best we have, but it's still deplorably incomplete. Hate crimes are vastly underreported. Last year, more than 16,000 law enforcement agencies took part in the data collection, yet only 2,000 agencies reported hate crimes. Over the past two decades, the FBI reported between 6,000 and 10,000 hate crimes each year in the U.S. But when the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS, surveyed large segments of the population between 2007 and 2011 to try to gauge the real number of hate crimes, it concluded that there are nearly 260,000 such crimes annually. So the FBI, although it's supposed to be our most reliable and current source of nationwide crime data, is potentially undercounting hate crimes by a magnitude of more than 40%. Still, the data we have suggests that hate crimes have increased in the last few years. It's probably not a coincidence that the rise in hate crimes parallels the rise of Donald Trump from fringe Republican candidate to Republican Party presidential nominee and President of the United States, a rise fueled by divisive, racist, and xenophobic rhetoric. A recent study at the University of Texas showed that counties that had hosted a 2016 Trump campaign rally saw a 226% increase in reported hate crimes over comparable counties that did not host such a rally. The study is the first to quantify how Trump's very presence might increase hostility against marginalized people. Their analysis included all reports of vandalism, intimidation, and assault following Trump's rallies. The researchers don't directly blame Trump for the rise in hate crimes, but they do acknowledge the Trump effect in public schools, in which young people mimic Trump's abusive words and actions against their peers. Only the most diehard Trump supporters would deny that Trump has normalized racist speech, encouraged and excused white nationalists, like the fine people who marched in Charlottesville, called Mexicans murderers and rapists, equated Muslim Americans with terrorists, and fanned the flames of white grievance. He has made thinly veiled threats to his political opponents. He's praised supporters for attacking journalists and praised police for roughing up arrested suspects. He and his party have encouraged hate mongers to come out in the open. Part of the mission of this podcast is to examine what happens when people feel encouraged to act on their hatred of others just for being different from them. In this episode, we focus on the small town of Aquila, Oklahoma, population 492, 2 hours south of Oklahoma City, and just an hour away from Dallas, Texas. The racial makeup of the town was 71.34% white, 0.2% African American, 22.3% Native American, 0.4% Asian, and 0.4% from other races, and 5.34% from two or more races. Hispanic or Latino of any race were 59% of the population. It's safe to say that Aquila is firmly nestled in what can be called Trump country. In 2016, Trump carried Oklahoma by a wide margin with 65.32% of the vote. He took Bryan County, where Aquila is located, by an even wider margin with 75.83% of the vote. In 2017, the Rose family moved to Aquila from Sherman, Texas, with their daughter Madison, or Maddie for short. Madison Kleeman Rose was a pretty typical Oklahoma 12-year-old. She enjoyed school, she dances at the drop of a hat, and she loves going to church. The only difference is Maddie is transgender. According to her mother, Brandy K. Rose, it was clear from an early age that Maddie was different. As early as age 2, she always wanted pink blankets and ruffles for her room, Rose said. I knew it wasn't typical, but being transgender never occurred to me. I didn't even know what transgender was at that time. I thought she would probably grow up to be a very, very gay boy. By age 6, Maddie was insisting that she was a girl to just about anyone who would listen. Her family initially allowed her to present as a girl at home, but to continue presenting as a boy at school. We sought out a therapist to help us understand what was happening, Maddie's mom recalled. The therapist spent time with us and eventually suggested that Maddie was transgender. It was a learning experience, but it made sense. The therapist suggested that we let Maddie be who she says she is and accept her. So we did that. From that moment on, we started her transition at school, too. On her first day of fourth grade at Sherman Middle School, Maddie started presenting as a girl at school. Bullying soon started because some students remembered her as Matthew. Her parents said students forced her into the boys' bathroom and told her to kill herself. The hostility got so bad that even Maddie's siblings were involved, so eventually we decided to move to Aquila and give Maddie a fresh start, Rose recalled. We had family there, most of whom had been supportive of Maddie's transition. When she started her new school in Aquila, she was Maddie and no one else. Problems started at Aquila Elementary School when Maddie was called to the principal's office. Going through her files to find test scores from Texas, school officials came across records that still referred to her as Matthew and called her to the office to ask her about it. The visit horrified Maddie, and she called her mother in tears. Rumors started soon after the visit to the principal's office. The school says that Maddie outed herself to other students, but Maddie and her family insist she didn't tell anyone outside of the office. Things worsened in August when Maddie started the seventh grade. Back in fifth grade, Maddie's parents had arranged with the school for her to use the staff bathroom. Bathrooms became a hot-button political issue a few years ago, as states debated laws prohibiting transgender people from using the public restrooms of their gender identity. Last January, an Oklahoma state lawmaker introduced a bill that would have restricted the rights of transgender people to use the bathroom of their gender identity, but the bill never came up for a vote. When she started seventh grade, Maddie moved to a new building. In the rush of beginning a new school year, none of the adults in charge remembered to tell her how to find the staff bathroom. So Maddie used the girls' bathroom. In 2017, the Trump administration rescinded Obama-era protections for transgender students that allowed them to use the bathroom corresponding with their gender identity. Rumors began that Maddie was regularly using the girls' bathrooms and, quote, peering over the stalls at other girls. Maddie had a confrontation with Bernie Crenshaw, an adult man, when she attended a father-daughter dance with her stepdad, Corey Rose, in April. Crenshaw repeatedly asked her if she was a boy, and she kept on saying she was a girl until her father intervened. My personal opinion is when you're asking somebody if you're a boy or a girl, you're asking what their genitalia is, Rose said. My daughter's genitalia? None of your business. Miss Rose obtained a protection order against Mr. Crenshaw after she said he blocked her in the road on a Friday morning and verbally assaulted her about Maddie shortly after they dropped their children off at school. She also cited Crenshaw's confrontation with her husband at the father-daughter dance he attended with Maddie. Soon after this, the unofficial Facebook page Aquila ISD Parent Group appeared. Aquila ISD Parent Group was not endorsed by the school district. Parents and other adults made threatening posts about Maddie to the group. At this point, I'd like to clarify, I'm reading direct quotes in which the parents in the Facebook group repeatedly misgendered Maddie. Bernie's wife, Jamie Crenshaw, posted, "The transgender is already using the girls' bathroom, accusing Maddie of spying on other children in the restroom. Enough is enough. We've been told how the school has gone above and beyond to make sure he has his own restroom, and yet he is still using the girls. Really, it looks like it's going to be a long year." The worst posts threatened physical violence, involving genital mutilation. Eddie Belcher, age 79, of Broken Arrow, posted, "If he really wants to be a female, make him a female. A good sharp knife will do the job really quick." Kevin Bickerstaff posted, "Just tell the kids to kick ass in the bathroom and it won't want to come back." Seth Shelby Cooper posted, "Let Parker, son of Bernie and Jamie Crenshaw, whip his ass until he quits coming to school." Ty Hayes posted, "This is terrible. Y'all have great kids and a little half-baked maggot is causing them probs." Dave Williams posted, "Ty Hayes, you know we have open hunting seasons on them kind. Ain't no bag limit in them either." The posts have long since been taken down, but not before they were screen captured and widely posted on social media by people concerned with violent threats made against a child. Maddie, terrified, started sleeping in her parents' room. There was a window in Maddie's bedroom, and she was afraid someone would crawl through it and get her in the middle of the night, Rose said. She was absolutely petrified. "We knew we had to move again, but we could not afford it. We just did not know what to do. We needed to save our daughter, but how?" The posts were enough to prompt school officials to cancel classes and close school for 2 days. A protest supporting Maddie was planned and a counter-protest, too. More than 24 people marched through the pouring rain, wearing sparkly silver duct tape across their mouths in a silent show of support for Maddie. A similar number of counter-protesters assembled elsewhere but quickly left during a huge downpour. School Superintendent Rick Bean said that given the threats and the police believing that there was a credible possibility of problems if the school opened, he decided to close school for everyone's safety. Superintendent Bean released a statement stating that he was humiliated by the words of the parents on the Facebook page and was working to resolve the issue, including hiring an extra resource officer. Mr. Bean said he hired a hall monitor to ensure that students aren't bullied. The school district has a no-tolerance policy for bullying, according to its website. The Facebook group is already facing potential consequences. Bryan County Sheriff Johnny Christian said that his department was investigating threats made about Maddie. "In all my years in law enforcement, I've not heard of anything like this, and I've been in law enforcement for 31 years, Christian said. "It's just incredible that adults would threaten a child." Maddie's story caught the attention of the national media, including Time Magazine, ABC News, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. The response was overwhelming. A woman in Oklahoma City asked Brandy K. Rose for permission to start a GoFundMe campaign to help the family relocate. The initial goal was $15,000. By September, the total had reached $54,000. "It was such an amazing blessing," Rose said of the campaign. "We have family in Houston, but it has never been a financial possibility to move there until now." Houston has so many more resources for Maddie, and it is so welcoming. It will be life-changing for all of us. A representative from the Montrose Center's Hatch Youth Program, which provides a safe space for LGBTQ youth, said the group was looking forward to getting to know Maddie and introducing her to other members. "I'm so happy that Houston has Hatch," Rose said. "I always worry that Maddie feels alone, and thanks to Hatch, she will know she's not." Rose and Maddie also met with the Spring Independent School District administrators and counselors in advance of their arrival. They were delighted with the warm reception they received, a stark contrast from the situation in Oklahoma. Sylvia Wood, a spokeswoman for Spring ISD, said the district prohibits discrimination based on gender. This includes transgender or students who do not conform to stereotypical notions of gender identity, Wood said. The district also has a very effective anti-bullying policy. For her part, Maddie didn't let the negativity and hostility of some parents affect her. Some adults out there do get it, and they don't support it, and that's their choice. They can be hateful and rude about it, but they ain't dragging me down, she said. Everyone's different, no one's the same, Maddie added. We're all different, unique, and special in our own way. I'm going to keep my head held up high and stay strong and go to school, she said in an interview, and I won't let those bullies drag me down. The support pouring in from around the country boosted Maddie's confidence. She decided to enter her new school situation as a fully out transgender girl. By now, she and her family have settled in Houston, and Maddie is going to school in a safe and supporting environment, making new friends and just enjoying her youth without worrying about bullying or threats of violence. Back in Akilé, things didn't quite settle down. Ironically, while the whole controversy around Maddie was going on, the town's mayor was an openly gay man, David Northcutt. Northcutt said the town looked beyond sexual orientation when voting him in, but that doesn't apply to all residents. On Saturday, March 2nd, Northcutt was attacked while shopping at a gas station convenience store on Highway 78. Bernie Crenshaw walked into the store and saw Northcutt buying lunch. He verbally attacked Northcutt with homophobic slurs. Crenshaw tried to get Northcutt to leave the store and fight him outside. I told him I had no intentions of leaving the store, Northcutt said. I had no intentions of fighting him, just simply leave me alone. When Northcutt tried to leave, witnesses said Crenshaw wouldn't let him, first punching him in the face, and when Northcutt fell to the ground, Crenshaw stomped on him. Northcutt said he was hit in the back of the head with a case of beer and briefly knocked unconscious. Northcutt suffered a broken nose, two black eyes, and received several stitches. He was taken to Texoma Medical Center by ambulance, treated for his injuries, and released. At last report, Crenshaw is on the run from authorities and still at large, according to the most recent reports I could find. The FBI is investigating the attack as a hate crime. If convicted, Bernie Crenshaw could face up to 10 years in prison. The Hate Crime Files podcast is researched, written, produced, and hosted by Terrence Heath. That's me. Thanks for listening. And to all my listeners and subscribers, thanks again for your support. I'll be back with another episode on the first of the month. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support it, please subscribe, tell your friends and family about it, and consider leaving a positive review at iTunes Podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, be careful out there and be good to each other.